Hermit crabs often outgrow their shell and need to find a new one.
I'm tired. You're lucky. I will not interrupt you today during the intro.
I can see James Eel grin, though.
No, I did that last time. That was my intro last time. Oh, sorry. I was meant to interrupt you during that.
Welcome.
But I didn't promise anything.
To fuck off a lot of yous. I'm Rasmus.
I'm Red.
And frankly, I'm just disappointed in you for listening to this.
But you're not.
That goes for the rest of us as well. We have no idea what you're doing with your life if you're here listening to us yappering on week after week after week.
Yeah, but it's their choice. We have to respect that. So, welcome. And welcome, James.
Thank you. Do you want to start again and I say my name, or should we just keep going?
No, we keep going. That's fine.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's kind of a tradition to have a fucked up intro in every episode now, so that's fine. But Rasmus is still very, like...
He tries every time.
Yeah. That's great. I admire it.
What, you envy my youthful naivete?
Somehow, yeah. Maybe. Yeah. And I don't even find a word for the feeling that I feel at the moment. Like, it's pure admiration of your consistency, maybe. I don't know.
I have my
or your trust in us, or whatever it is. Anyway, how are you guys?
I'm questioning if this is like a midlife crisis martial art, consistent podcasting.
I guess you could call it something like that, maybe.
Oh, that's great. Love that.
Anyway, I'm very well.
Cool. How is
so
the
am
family?
I.
Me too. James, how is the family?
Family is going very well. So Rosie, my daughter, is 7 months old and one day, actually.
Yeah.
It has equally been very fast and very slow.
Yeah.
I think the first 6 months, people often say, is the hardest bit. A lot of it is... I was trying to... Because I thought we'd probably talk about this. It's a little bit like... Not that I have any aspirations to run a marathon, but it's difficult in both of the ways things can be difficult.
Yeah.
Difficult in that it's consistently hard. It's hard work over a long period of time. And each event can be a lot of effort.
Yeah.
But unlike running a marathon, you can't just decide to stop doing it on a day because you feel tired.
Yeah. No, that's you don't have that option.
Yeah.
But you're mentioning it's like 6 months. For me, it was the first 2 years were very difficult. Not because you're absolutely right. The first 6 months is you sleep last night and you have something to do all the time. You have to prep stuff in advance. And I took a break after 2 years because you have this relief because you know that your kid is not going to die during his sleep.
The constant state of fear.
Oh,
your
brain
decides that, I wonder if, what happens if sharks decided to fly? What would I do? It's that feeling. But
no, but you know, you have these things, I don't remember how it's called in English, but it's like sudden death, baby, sudden death, something, during the first 18 months or 2 years of something.
Yeah.
If you put the kid in a bad position during their sleep, they can just die. And it was such a big fear of mine that oftentimes at night I would go into my kid's room just to check if he was breathing. Mm-hmm. And I, when he was two, it was like, okay, that's over. I can now sleep a little bit better because I know he's going to be alive tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. So not to put too much pressure on you, James, but...
No. I've spoken to people with kids who are in, you know, their late teens, and they said, oh, don't worry, that fear that something's going to go wrong or
it's going to be worse.
Normal and persistent. But the nice thing is that as much as I think we all, as parents, talk about the things that are difficult, it's amazing. Like it is
absolutely
something that I think there's a lot of trepidation. People think, oh no, and like, you focus so, you only ever hear people talking about the bad things, but it is the best thing I have done.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same. It's the best thing that ever happened to me.
I did make a bripe as well, and the bripe was pretty good. this is easily better. Who would have thought it?
People who don't have kids don't understand, maybe, and I hope they will. But yeah, I when I say that to people who don't have kids yet, like, it's the best thing that happened to me in my whole life. They are like, yeah, but you're exaggerating, or you say that because you have a child. Yeah, I say that because I have a child, obviously. But that's great. With all the fear and the fatigue and the worries and everything, it's so worth it. So,
I have to ask, though, because I can't imagine there's a very big overlap between people who have both a child or a toddler and people who have a bribe. And it's like, is James the outlier thinking the baby is better?
I mean, the Venn diagram is pretty small.
Yeah, I mean...
feel free, any other bribe users out there, feel free to reach out and we can discuss this. But otherwise, life is good. I'm enjoying work. I was in the workshop yesterday, I think. Timing is hard.
Yeah.
But yeah, yesterday. And I had a really makery day.
Nice.
Did some welding in the morning. Then I did some metalwork, grinding an axe, leatherwork to fix it, and vinyl. Nice. Cast. Yeah, it was. I felt like a real maker. In other words, not good at any one thing, but good at doing lots of things.
Yeah.
And that's great. Good at getting yourself distracted by, ooh, that thing is shiny, or maybe that's too rusty, or.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, you know that table I made? Maybe I should. No. Focus. Focus. First, we're changing the light bulb so we can see the thing that we're doing. And then, what was it I was going to do?
I saw the thing that you 3D print for the trap in the rooftop.
Yeah. That is, I think, the fourth time I've printed that. Because if for the non-visual people who, for some reason, haven't joined the Two Thirds Focus Patreon and are not taking advantage of the fantastic video.
well done.
Text in the post, yeah. I have a loft hatch. So I think in the roof, like a trap door, but you're looking at it from the underneath. And to open it, you need to hook a little hook on the end of a metal bar through it and pull down. Obviously, the door swings through 90 degrees. If you don't swing the pole through 90 degrees, all you do is snap off that piece of plastic. The original one snapped off, and I have surprise disassembled three others.
Mm-hmm.
I've iterated on this, and I now have the perfect prints in 17 minutes, part, something like that.
Nice.
And yeah, it is very satisfying to replace.
Not to create more problems, but you could have milled one if you had a milling machine. And make one from aluminum or something?
I could. So I was actually doing, I don't think I've shared it on Instagram yet, but I was doing some milling the other day.
Oh.
To our friend the Wizard and this old Tony. So Jamie Reader reminded me that this old Tony cut two teeth out of his arbor press. I think Jamie did it with brute force and angle grinder. I used the milling machine and yeah, I could have milled one out of aluminium, but... points of failure. Which bit do you want to fail? Was my thought, and I will get the cheap plastic part that I can print myself rather than bending a pole.
Yeah, that's.
I mean, that is a very fair thing to consider. Like, which part is more expensive or more difficult to replace if it breaks? And when you already solved the problem of the thing Bractimadu and 3D printing, then it's like, well, if this breaks again, it will take half an hour on the printer.
Yeah, if that half an hour total from accidentally disassembling it to okay, I fixed it.
Yeah.
But you take out the pleasure of milling on the milling machine for like 2 days to get the parts absolutely right, instead of just pushing a button and having the part ready in printer in 15 minutes.
Well,
it's the fun out of it.
The first time I think I would have found it fun. The second time when I had to remake it, I don't think that would have been fun.
Yeah, sure.
But how about you, Raz? You said you were doing well.
Yes, now I'm doing better because I had to refix my car today.
Ooh.
No, yeah, I know. It's Rasmus.
Your turn now.
So I had an interesting experience because I was going to buy more welding gas yesterday. And because I do that like driving to and from the workshop, but it was already late and I need to double check where I can get the welding gas at what sort of gas booth vending machine looking thing. I went home, I checked that, and then I was supposed to go the next morning. I went to the machine next morning and I couldn't get any of the doors to the boot open on my car.
Okay.
The side door has been like iffy for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But suddenly the back door was just, no, I am locked.
She's permanent. Rebelling against you. She doesn't like you anymore. She's angry at you. You did something wrong.
I did apparently either too much or too little. We can argue which one. But I phone up my mechanic friend and go like, hey, I have problem. And I tell him, I was like, okay, so rule number one, when one door to a room starts to get iffy, fix it immediately because the other ones will follow shortly. So we managed to get the side door open. Then I crawled. I mean, it's a visual partner. It's not difficult to get crawl around into, but I had to go in there and then open the door from the inside and then take the panel off and see like, oh, it's leaking hydraulic fluid from the actuator that engages the handle and the lock. So the central locking system, well, the only thing it does is disengage the handle from the locking mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And it was leaking oil, but the way it works is that it is what's it called, double-sided, so it pushes either up or down. But when it's pushing it up again, of course, there's a lot of space taken up by the cylinder inside of it, so it required less oil. Make sense?
Yeah. So it does fail safe in a way. It fails locking your car.
Yeah, which is the problem I kind of want to have. So we ended up cutting a hole into the back panel of the door so that I can reach in and stick that actuator.
Of course you did.
So that I can decide if I want the car to be permanently locked or permanently open.
Good thinking.
Just clarify, you cut a hole in the back door to put your finger in and wiggle it up and down?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Wanted to
just checking.
Clear that up. So we're all on the same page about exactly what's happening.
Don't think too much about it, but it's fine. So now the car is fine-ish again. But then, as I mentioned to Red earlier today as well, like, there's a few other things with the car that is starting to become less good. And I mentioned his mechanic friend, and he looked at me and was like, yeah, and I've also been working on this car. Consider buying a new one before the next MOT.
Yeah. That sounds like
so
a good
idea.
So I
need to save money for that.
Yeah.
But, luckily.
Don't buy a French one next time.
I need to see what my budget can afford, but the car is 17 years old now, and it's gone 190-something kilometers. So
mine is older. And I've seen more mileage.
Yeah, and also we know how more often you talk about your car on this podcast.
Yeah, because I take care of her. Because I love her. And you don't. That's the problem.
it's a tool. It's a working tool. It's a work car. That's the word.
But don't they say, if you can't afford to buy a new French car, you can't afford to buy an used French car.
I never heard that. I'll ignore that thing.
Yeah.
But in other news, which is good when it comes to saving money, is I got a pallet of laser cut parts from delivered the other day.
Nice.
Which is not yesterday. No, nice. Maybe it was. I don't recall anymore. As I said, time is fluid. Which consisted of all of the new guillotine parts that I ordered.
Ooh. Nice.
And because the laser cutter company is excellent to me, I asked for 10 and they gave me 12.
Nice.
I have sold 11 of them.
Nice.
Did you sell the 11th before you knew you were getting 12? Or
No. Okay. I sold 9. I said, yay, I got the parts for this. And two more people wanted them. And I was like, good, maybe I can keep one for myself. I need to order more parts. And I also got the new shell that I'll be assembling for the new gas forge.
Mm-hmm.
But not new gas, but I'm rebuilding it because the way I built it, I had the stones in the side laying flat, which means if
thickness.
I turn them, more thickness and a lot more thermal mass to heat up the walls. But if I turn them sort of on the side,
more space,
I'll have 2 in the height, which is slightly more than the 3 I have flat like now. It doesn't make sense. I'm rebuilding it because I want to try if less thermal mass means that it will heat up a bit quicker. But then I also talked to a friend of mine and he said that, well, I have a smaller gas forge and I have a 12-inch burner.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I'm using a 6-inch for a really big gas forge. Maybe I should rethink this part.
Yeah.
So I might have also ended up putting an order in for a 12-inch burner cost by a guy here in Norway. And worst case, if I don't care to buy all of the extra spare parts of piping, I will do some disassembly and reassembly of gas forges in the future. But that's not really an issue. Currently, I just need a big box on fire that 6 students can work out at a time. And now I also ordered the sides or the new sidewalls of the new gas forge to be in stainless, so they won't scale up.
Mm-hmm.
I hope, he said very optimistically.
Yeah.
Lots of things going on, despite I'm pretending to have vacation because it's Easter. But
cool.
Yeah. How about you, Red?
Nothing. Nothing. Nothing new. I've got my computer working again. I mentioned that in a previous episode, so maybe. I don't know. I don't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I decided to order new parts for a new computer, and I got most of them. So I will be soon building a new computer so I can give my current one to my son as a present in June. And have because I kind of don't trust my computer anymore. Weirdly enough, I shouldn't, I know, but you know.
Did you figure out what the problem was? Because your graphics card got fried.
Yeah.
But it was something.
And the motherboard got fried.
And you were sent a thing to check the power supply and...
And I did, and the power supply was completely fine. And I think I managed to find what the problem was. And it was the power supply extension cables that I bought because it was beautiful to put that stuff in the computer because it all makes sense, like color-wise and stuff. But I think that's what failed, and had a short circuit somewhere and fried the motherboard and the graphic card. So luckily, I only had to buy a new motherboard. That was not that expensive because like AM4 models, the old stuff, it doesn't really matter. But yeah, $150 or so. So my computer is running fine now, but my kids have been wanting a computer for the past 2 years. He's young still, and he's only going to use it to play Fortnite, probably, and Minecraft. But that's fine, because in like, not next year, but the year after that, it will be in middle school, and they will need a computer to work. So it's just a gift in advance a little bit, but that's also a good opportunity for me to spend so much money on a new computer. But yeah. Can't wait. It'll be great. Other than that, nothing really new, like the usual. And today I took the day off completely to just do nothing and enjoy doing nothing, which I don't often do. So that was a good day, actually. And I took a nap, and it was a really good nap as well.
I guess giving the computer to your son is kind of good forward planning, because sometimes you think, oh, should I just come up with like a temporary solution, or maybe I should invest stuff early on and put the effort in early and maybe it'll pay dividends. But I do find that's a pretty difficult topic to navigate.
Absolutely. And that was a great segue, James. Thank you for the
It was so great. I nearly considered not to say anything, but then read.
We have to. It's a tradition in the podcast. We have to mention the.
We need to make sure that Steve understands that this is a segue happening.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's podcasting traditions. You have to start a new make one every year. You have to not release it on the day that you do it, and you have to call out segues.
Exactly. Exactly. No, but that's a very good point that you have, and a good idea for a topic. Do a temporary solution is viable long term, or should you take the time to think stuff before doing them? What do you think, guys? Raz, I know sometimes you are faced with problem in the workshop that you have to find a solution for like very quickly. You mentioned previously that you are having students for class, blacksmith classes, and you need to arrange the workshop. So is it something that you do on a regular basis, or is it something that you plan on doing like once and for all, like setting up the shop for all the students that you can have in the workshop for the classes? Or else?
It's a bit back and forth. When it comes to students, I want it to be, because I do it so often, I want it to be as easy as possible to let as many people into Forge at once.
Mm-hmm.
So I have put up a lot of systems around that to make it as easy as possible. But still, like every single class, I'm reminded of, oh, I should improve upon that. I should do this thing a bit better.
Mm-hmm.
and so on and so forth. Something I'm hoping to get a chance to do tomorrow, now that I actually have some fucking welding gas again, is to weld some small tool stands that I can place around the workshop so that students actually have a place to put their tongs and don't try to do it's the smart thing of putting really hot tongs on a pile of wood.
Yeah.
Which is like, it makes perfect sense because they're not used to everything around them being a fire hazard.
Yeah.
And just being aware that I can put down things anywhere except for where things are flammable.
You can just give them a hook to put on their belt so they can put the hot pair of tongs on their belt and they will learn very quickly that that's not something that you should be doing.
I might consider that just to brand the stupid ones.
And you can sell marked up pairs of trousers on, you know, on the special souvenir.
Yeah.
What about you, James? I know you have your workshop in the shed, but you have also a bigger workshop. How did you manage to organize the workshop, both of your workshop? Was it a long thought process, or was it like, I need this now, so I'm going to put it here and we'll see with time how it goes?
So looking back at it is very different than when you start. And I think when people say, oh, getting organized or organizing your workshop, it's not an event that happens.
Mm.
I think there are workshops. You know, you look at Formula One teams, it's incredibly specific. It's incredibly neat. Everything has a place and there's a place for everything. But they're the exception. They're not standard. Mm. Being organized is a process. So you don't suddenly, one day you've got everything in its place and it is organized. It is a process of, actually, you know what? This has been the way it has for a while. And now I've got a new tool, or I've got, you know, more space or less space, and you have to reorganize. So for the workshop I'm in at the moment, the one in my garden in the shed in the garden, this is the second iteration of things. And the first one I had, this space is, I think, 2.5 by 3 meters, maybe. I had tables running down both sides, and I thought that was good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Until I wanted a slightly more sturdy table. And then it was good until I needed to move my computer down it.
Yeah. Mm.
So I think when you start out, the main thing is you shouldn't let getting started be an issue, except this is going to be temporary and just go.
Yeah.
Because as good an idea as you have, like I drew this all out in CAD and thought, oh, I'm going to put this here and that there. And then suddenly you realize, oh, I don't do that. What are your assumptions are wrong.
Yeah.
So I'm a big believer, because the kind of similar concept is tools, isn't it? You know, like, do you buy once, cry once and just get the good tool, or do you get a cheap one, see if you like it, and then if you do, get a better one?
Yeah.
The difference here is that I don't think anyone reuses the crappy first router that they bought to make a better router. But every table in the workshop, the tabletop gets used for something else, even if that is a scrap bin or something else. The steel you can reuse if you make the table.
Yeah.
So I had in my big workshop some kind of expanding leg temporary tables for a long period of time, and that had some tools on, and quickly I realized it's adequate for storage, but it's not going to work for doing stuff. So then I thought, well, like, I'll beef them up. And by that point, I realized, actually, if I make three all the same, I will have space for, you know, I'll have a use for them at some point. So I think it becomes apparent. Like, you don't let, you know, being certain about something hold you back from starting. I tend to have found that it's kind of obvious the point at which you need to redo something.
I mean, yeah, it can be obvious, but at the same time, it can be difficult to prioritize to do it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's that sort of middle ground of it is bad, but not horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I think people often say about if they're in a job that they hate, if it's just not bad enough, they never leave. If it's 1% worse, then you'll leave. It's the same as, you know, everyone can think in their workshop of that tool that's not really in the right place and it's not that good, but it's adequately okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had the experience already to have to change something mid-project because the organization of the shop was not fitting the project. So I was like, everything's fine, it's working great, but you have this one project, which is a little bit bigger than what you are usually do. And therefore, the bandsaw, which was like just in the corner of your workshop, it was all working great. But now it's you can't work because the bandsaw is there. So you have to move the bandsaw. If you move the bandsaw, you have to move the welder. If you move the welder, you have to move the workbench and so on and so on. So that's what I wanted to avoid when I came in this workshop in my space I'm actually working in. I wanted to be organized well enough to not be faced with this problem again. But I'm mainly doing leather work here, so I don't have that big 2x4 to work with. So it's just like pelt and hides and leather straps, and so that's okay. But still, having on the corner of my bench one press is sometimes it's annoying to have it here. So I made it removable so I can clear the way and work on bigger projects. And the other day I was like doing this, and yet I didn't have enough space, so I had to redo stuff. And I took 2 days to make more shelves, more storage zones in the workshop, so I can clear the bench up a little bit to be more comfortable to work with the current tool that I have. I think the problem that it's not only our organization, but the problem that we have is we tend to, as we expand and grow or get more skilled in a field, buy more tools or better tools. And then you have the problem of storage, but you have also the problem of organization. Which tool do we use more often? Mm. Therefore, those you have to keep next to you, because that you will gain time in setting the tools if it's not like set up properly all the time. So it's not only organization, how you organize your space, but also the amount of tools that you have. Like, I had to get rid of.
No, shut up. I just realized that I probably could rearrange the workshop and have a better workflow.
Yeah, you could probably. And as James was saying, it's always changing. I think you can't be like done with the organization of a workshop. If you are more space, less space, more student, less students, it works differently. Unless you are like me, working alone in a closed space that won't change for the next 10 years, and you know it, you have to make the better of the space that you have, and therefore you can organize your shop the way you want it and or the way it works for you. But it's not from the very first day that you will be sure that it's going to work, because I took like a week to think about it. You have to use it, and you have to know how your work will define the need that you will have when it comes to your workshop.
I mean, in your world, right? I think that's maybe a bit easier because most of the things you do are so contained within the same set of tools.
Yeah.
Whereas if, like in James's case or in mine, where we are doing so many different things, granted, all of my things are also kind of contained within the same kind of tools, but the scope and size of them change so much. And James, like, you have a literal hangar that is full of stuff.
Yeah.
And then you have so many moving parts that you need to work around and work with, that suddenly it's a lot more complex to try to make things work in the way you need to. And the way you need them to work will change so much more often.
But I think the thing that is common to every workshop, no matter the size, in the same setup is tidying up.
Mm. Yeah.
The temporary solution, I will clear just enough space to do the thing that I think I need. When do you invoke clean shop, happy shop? And when do you just go, if I push everything towards the wall, it won't fall off and it will be slightly tidier.
Yeah.
You know, I've done that too. I'm kind of lucky, as you said, Raz, here I'm doing leather working. So if I spin around, I'm facing my other workbench, and every tool that I need, I can grab them without even standing, and I can do everything that I need. But I'm lucky enough to have also a small forge at my parents' house, and to be able to work and do metalworking or woodworking in my dad's garage or outside of the garage, depending on the weather and what I'm doing. But I shared that space with my dad for a few years, and our philosophy is completely different. My dad is the kind of, I'm going to push that on the side and do whatever I need to do. I need a clean space to start a new project. So
you have been working on the same old project for the last 3 months?
Oh, yeah. No, but when do you invoke the Clean Shop, Happy Shop? For me, it's before any project or after any project. When something is done, I clean everything up because I need, for my personal organization, I need a clean shop. I need to know exactly where the tools I'm going to need are. And so I put them back in place, like every single day. My dad put everything in a box until the project is done. He knows that the tools that he will need are in that box. So that's fine for him. If we are working in a car, he will take the box. We go to the car, yeah. We fix the car, and he keeps doing that the next day and so on and so on. Personally, I need to put back the tools. I need to put the tools back where they belong every single day. So the next day when I will need them, I know where to find them. Mm. And I need a clean space to start the project. So we have a very different approach when it comes to cleaning the shop or organizing a shop, putting the tools and working on a project, which is fine. But sometimes it can be hard because I think we are complementary to this at this point, because we've done that for a few years now. So we know how each of us is working and we respect that. And so that's fine. Mm. At the very beginning, when I was started working in his garage, it was very hard because he was not used to my way of doing things. And I was not used to his, I was, because 40 years of experience with him, but
you developed your own routine of things.
Yeah, exactly. So now being in the shop at the same time with him and with someone, can be, in my case, it's my dad, but it can be any other maker or student or whoever, it's kind of hard to adapt and not be bothered by the way other person are using the space. So it's a kind of a challenge to share a space with someone. And I admire people like Steve, because we were talking about Steve previously, who are able to share a space with other makers, blacksmiths in that case. And everything is going fine because they all adapt to the way other people work and use the tool and use the space and use the workshop. Yeah. I'm working alone, so I'm not, now I'm most of the time I'm working alone in my place, so I'm not used to that anymore. So the workshop organization is very different when it comes to your workshop and a workshop that you have to share with someone. And therefore, when you are alone, you can do whatever you want and that works for you. But when it's a different workshop that you have to share, or you will welcome people in for a class, for example, you have to organize things differently, not only for the workshop be a good place for you and that your productivity doesn't decline, but also for the other people, if that makes sense, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's a skill, isn't it? Working with other people.
Yeah.
And I think oftentimes makers often think, oh, no, I wish I had my own space. I would be so much better. But there's certainly something about working in a team that, you know, you're held to account.
Yeah.
You maybe, everyone has different skills, you know, personal skills. Maybe you're a good leader. Maybe you're a good, you know, you are good at organization.
Mm.
And actually, if you're working within that team, you might be the one that, you know, is great at starting projects, but never really wants to finish them.
Yeah.
And equally, if you don't like tidying up and someone else is there to say, hey, look, we've got 10 minutes where we're just waiting for something, let's quickly run around and tidy up.
Mm.
You can end up building those habits in. Something I at work heard is, it's not about wasting time. So you often think if there's an emergency happening, you need to run in and go and do the thing.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, if you spend 10 seconds just waiting, get your mental game, kind of get your head in,
yeah,
realize what's going on. People say, no, why are you wasting 10 seconds? I'm not wasting 10 seconds. I'm investing 10 seconds in myself.
Yes. Yeah.
Before
yeah.
I start a project, as much as I don't want to tidy up, or when I've got 3 hours in the workshop, I don't want to spend the last half an hour tidying up. I want to be working right up to the minute I leave and spend 30 seconds washing my hands at the end. If I invest 30 minutes at the end tidying up, getting it ready for future me, it's going to be so much better.
I think I learned back into Scouts that you're never supposed to run towards an emergency. You're always supposed to walk.
There's a funny thing of emergencies in the hospital. Because where I work, we're kind of on multiple levels, but there's a big open area and you can see people on the lower floors because I work on the top floor. Mm-hmm. I can see people running. And I go, they're the most junior person. They're running.
Yeah.
Is that because it can create more danger when you are running? You can hurt yourself when you're running to help someone, and therefore you will not able to help if you hurt yourself before you reach them?
Yeah, the first...
Or because you're not mentally prepared to face whatever you have to face.
So for most of it, it's the first thing you do is check for danger.
Yeah.
And that's the difficulty when people teach first aid often is they're like, look out for electrical wires and look out for like fires. And I was like, I've never been in an emergency where there is spontaneously an electrical wire flailing around.
But you haven't lived, James. you need to go out more often.
Yeah, I do.
It happens all the time.
but the real dangers are much more subtle. It's things like running past someone who's saying, oh, actually, I know what's going on.
Mm.
It's not diving into situations. It's going into, and yes, where I work in a hospital, there are people who are trained to provide like the immediate medical care.
Yeah.
I'm turning up as an expert. I don't need to be the first person there. Anybody can do the basic bit at the beginning. And that's more or less the only bit that's evidence-based to work anyway.
Yeah.
What they want is someone turning up with kind of a clear head, a bit of expertise to say, right, I understand what's happening now. I've made a really good assessment. Let's do this.
Yeah.
Mm. And equally, when I start a project, I'm terribly guilty of, right, all I need to do is just quickly. What I need to actually do is do the project properly. Like I was talking about repairing chairs earlier. So they're bar stools and they've got a wooden base that's held onto a metal frame. And what I really wanted to do is, if I just peel back the cover and then grind off a little bit of the metal, what I could do is weld it and then quickly stick a cold rag on it so it doesn't catch fire.
Mm-hmm.
What I actually did was I took the entire cover off and it was a much better job.
Yeah.
And it is investing time. Yes, it might have taken me half an hour longer at most for a hour long job. Probably took me an extra 10 minutes and it was so much better than suddenly then having to go, well, I've set this on fire now. How do I fix this?
No, that's not the thing, though. That's sort of the...
Oh, the blacksmith wants to jump in on setting stuff on fire.
Okay. Yes, I do. This is stuff I know something about. It is kind of that balance between how much time do I need to invest to eliminate nearly all risk of this going badly, all chances of this going badly. And in your case, half an hour, and I'm pretty much guaranteed that this will not catch on fire. I will not destroy this thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, well... If that's a really, really important thing, really important job, then of course you do that. If it's 1 out of 100 and nobody cares, then maybe it's worth it to save that time. But that's kind of a balancing act between everything. But it can be difficult, I think, to realize which side of that equation you're currently on.
Mm. Especially production. Yeah, you have done production runs of things.
Yeah.
It's much easier to invest time when you're making 100. When you're only, I'm going to turn one bowl or I'm going to make one wallet,
it's
pretty easy to just get started, messed up. And then suddenly you're making two.
Yeah.
One is a failure. And you think,
Three and maybe more.
Yeah.
But what you said is very important. You said the quickly will kill you. And I learned that using my table saw one day. Now I'm very careful. It's a tool that I've been using for 6-7 years now on a regular basis. it still scares me to death, because that's one of the most dangerous tools that you can have in a workshop. I remember one day I was like, yeah, I need to cut that quickly. I was doing a project and I need to shorten a piece. I was like, I'm going to do that quickly. Didn't take the time to set the things properly. And I had a kickback, and the piece I was cutting flew 30 meters behind me.
Oh.
And thankfully, I was not in the way. I was just on the left side, because I was going to do the thing quickly, but I remembered what Jimmy said in one of his videos, don't stand here, because that's the most dangerous place for when you're using a table saw. I should also have remembered the time when he said, take your time, it's a dangerous tool, so do it properly and be present when you are doing it. We shouldn't be using any kind of tool quickly, because that's when you get hurt. So taking the time to half an hour or more to just set up the tools properly, to think about what you're going to do, what you need to do, and how you're going to do it, it will save you so much time in the end. Because if you go to the hospital for like a week because you've been hit in the head by a piece of wood, you didn't save time in any way.
Yeah. The phrase I like is, slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard that in a TV show, actually, and the guy didn't understood it. But I
think it's from Thinking Fast and Slow, and it's been copied so many times. But the thing I struggle with, it's not knowing that. I think we all know, like, be careful with power tools.
Mm.
Recognizing that you're rushing.
Yeah.
It's recognized, because you think, oh, no, it's all going fine. I'm in like flow state and this is great. And actually, it's recognizing situations.
Yeah, the problem is the excitement that you can feel at the very beginning of a project. You mentioned like, oh, I need a leather wallet, so I'm going to jump right in the project. But if you don't plan ahead, if you don't make a pattern, if you don't know what you're doing or how you're going to do it, you make two because you fucked up the first one. Mm-hmm. Same thing. The excitement of starting a new project can be so high, so big sometimes, that you just want to get started, and then you rush the things and you don't set up the tools properly, or you don't cut your leather properly on the first try, and then you waste time and you waste leather and you waste your energy and your excitement and everything that goes into a project at the beginning, and you have to do it all over again.
And but what's even worse is sometimes it works.
Sometimes it works.
Huge amounts of satisfaction. You're like, I rushed through this and I did it. I should do that again. And like, mentally, it's a weird mental trick that you have to say, no, I got lucky.
Yeah.
That this worked. This is, I should not be enjoying this dopamine. I'm going to put this dopamine over here and leave it. It's not earned. And that's how you end up, I think, with projects of like, it's all right. It's good enough.
Mm.
It is. Good things. Good things come to those who wait.
Do you have any of those still? Like, do you have temporary solutions that have stuck around for far too long?
Yeah. I even have a YouTube video called I Failed to Finish This Table, which is, somewhat.
All right, I remember.
It's the same table. It's adequate. I think I did add one more thing on, but it is the laziest way to make a table. It is create a square of steel and just weld some legs on vertically. Mm. No supports, no side bracing. It's fine as long as it's pushed up against the wall.
Yeah.
But it's not good.
Do you plan on redoing it or rework this table at some point in the near future?
If I move it, yes. And I did exactly that with the CNC table.
Mm.
I had to move it and I realized this is, it's something that kicks you to go, I've now got enough impetus. I've got enough push factor to make me change it.
Yeah.
Because inertia is incredibly powerful. We're all going to sit and leave things while they're fine.
Yeah.
So I find reorganizing the workshop is a really good way to go, and then I could do this and I could do this. And then you think, well, I'm already improving stuff. I'm going to, I had a tap fitting that forever was really annoying. And one day I thought, I wonder if I've got an adapter. And then I had an adapter. And then I thought, actually, I could put a cam lock fitting on. which is the fitting I use for the brewery hoses. Mm. Oh, and now I can like pipe fresh water directly through all my kit to clean it. Mm. You think, ah, and then I could improve the drain. And suddenly, like, the act of improving stuff becomes fun.
Yeah.
I think we all like that, like the continuous improvement thing. And I think something someone said to me recently is, we all think it's obvious. We all hang out with people with very similar mindsets. And I was doing something, and they're like, oh, no, that's a really good idea. I was like, no, it's incredibly obvious. They said, it's only obvious to you.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, someone would have done it.
Yeah.
And because we all hang out with similarly minded people, a lot of what we do, people go, oh, yeah, of course, I get that. Mm. But to muggles, what you're doing is actual magic. Don't ever forget that.
That is honestly one of the biggest gifts of teaching so much, is to be continuously reminded of how much stuff I actually know.
Mm.
Which boosts my ego tremendously, which probably everyone around me hates. But it is a little bit of that thing of, I'm trying to explain something, and then they ask a question that seems like so stupidly obvious that I didn't even consider that the question existed.
Yeah.
But it reframes the entire way I explain and teach this concept, because like, no, I know that now I know that this thing needs to be explained, and then everything will fall into place afterwards.
Yeah, but
it needs to build on itself.
You're still on the peak of the Dunning-Kruger effect, like mountain. And then you fall down to the valley of I know that I don't know. But it's great to be there as well.
Technically, that's not what Dunning-Kruger's original paper said. The graph is not in the paper.
Okay.
Go on.
Explain, James.
So you know the Dunning-Kruger graph. So the Dunning-Kruger effect is that, you know, you start off knowing stuff and then eventually you know more, but it's not a straight line between the two. Mm. And so it's confidence against experience or confidence against skill. Mm-hmm. So if you're driving, I'll describe it. As you get a little bit more experience, you feel like you know loads of stuff, and you get a little bit more experience, and then you realize you don't know a lot. And then it slowly improves. Their original paper doesn't, that graph is not in their original paper. It's a brilliant illustration. It does kind of talk about it in a roundabout way. And I think it's a lovely summary. It is probably true.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I think people miss about Dunning-Kruger and learning is feedback. Yeah. So when people give you feedback, you can never go from you feel you're good at something and to be you are good at something and you know it. Yeah. You can't go. So imagine like a 4x4 thing, like it's a Johari windows, a fancy term, and they're used for lots of different things, like the Donald Rumsfeld known knowns and unknown knowns.
Yes.
Yeah. So a 4x4 grid, there's being good at it and knowing you're good at it.
Mm-hmm.
So you start off in thinking you're good at it, you're knowing you're good at it, but you're not actually. You can't skip across to knowing you're good at it and being good at it. You have to go via thinking you're not good at it and knowing and not being good at it.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you can only go clockwise around it. And that's what feedback is. Feedback is telling someone, I'm sorry, you think you're good at this, but you are not. And that is the next step to getting better. You cannot go any other way. And I think that's the best bit of Dunning-Kruger, because everyone knows like, beginner's luck, I feel overconfident. But if someone tells you the only way to get better at this is to feel that you are bad at it.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm doing. I'm going to give you helpful feedback. That's Dunning-Kruger to me. Like, I like that bit of it. The graph is pretty, but it's not in their original paper.
I'm sure it wasn't, but it's a good visual way to understand and to express it, I think. But that's exactly it, whereas what you said. Like, when I started teaching, I was like, oh, I know more than those guys. So I was super confident, and I was kind of proud of myself to have gone through those years of studies and now be the one that teaches. But suddenly you have this question from a student and you're like, fuck, I don't know the answer. What do I do? Mm-hmm. And then you start to get that this humility of the teacher that is able to say, I don't know. I will do my research. I will come back to you next week with the answer. It's not because you are teaching something that you have to know everything, that you are supposed to know as much as you can, but you are not supposed to know everything about everything. And you can have flaws and stuff that you don't know about because they are recent. I'm a specialist of Japan. I don't know nothing about the new mangas that are being published last month because I don't care. First of all, I don't care about them. And I don't keep myself up to date in that matter. But I know enough to teach what I usually teach. But the humility of knowing that you don't know everything is what makes you a good teacher, I think, because you are always on the edge between, I know stuff I can show you, but if I don't, I can check, and then I will know and improve and I will get back to you. And if you keep repeating that as a teacher, as a maker, whatever, I think that's the, I don't want to say the way to greatness, but that's the way to just improve or be better and at some point be really good at what you are or what you do.
You can't skip through that nice little peek at the beginning of the Dunning-Kruger code.
Yeah.
You have to be the person saying, and it's so, like you said, it's so much easier to be asking the question of, oh, I don't know what that means, or I don't understand, when you know that you're quite experienced.
But everyone
has to start doing that because it is the only way to get, you can't skip the, you know.
I've met a few people who are certain that they are good at what they are doing, even though they are not, and they will never question themselves. Like, I know I'm good. I'm fucking good. Prove me wrong. And that's the kind of person that you don't want to engage with, because you if you are that certain of your level, you're still at the very beginning of the learning curve, and
you are one or the other. You are either the good at it and know you're good at it, or you're right at the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's very reassuring as someone, because almost all of us exist somewhere in that middle bit of, I know I'm not that great, to, oh, maybe I'm okay at this.
So knowing that we are not good, knowing that we are not great, what would you do to improve what you are currently doing when it comes to a solution that was temporary and should be improved in the future? I'm going to give you a quick example. When I moved in this workshop, I put my sewing machine in the corner because I was like, that's great. That's going to be great. Going to save me so much time when I'm going to do sewing and stitching. I'm going to put it next to the window so I have natural light. It's not in the way when I need to do other stuff. But it still it's not still set up properly, so I can't use it like on a regular basis, like every day to stitch or sew stuff. So that's something I need to improve in the near future to improve my workflow, to save time, and it will improve my workshop. So I had planned, but it was a temporary solution. It's here, but it's not fully functional, so it's not permanent. Is there something in your workflow, in your workshop, in your the way you do stuff, both of you, that you know that you need to fix soon and that you will?
Yeah, I have this. My grinding solution at the moment doesn't feel good.
Okay.
And it's just a result of, I had bench space, grinder goes on bench, I can now grind.
Okay.
But
makes sense.
But it's not bolted down. I don't have a dust extraction system. I don't have anything to make it a good space. It is just barely functional.
Okay.
I also don't have a good way of storing all of the accessories and tools for the grinder.
Mm-hmm.
They are just laying around under the bench.
As they should. as they do often.
Yeah.
No, but I understand.
Yeah. So it is that thing of, I want, I mean, also when it comes to just the dust in itself, I want a way to get that out of the workshop because I can't move away from it. It will linger in the air. So even if I'm wearing a mask every single time I am grinding, and even though metal dust is kind of heavy, it will fall down after a short while. If I do a lot of grinding, it will be in the air a lot longer. And then I will need to walk around with a mask for a while, or need a massive fan blowing and trying to push everything out the door or something. So it's not a good system, but it's functional.
Do you have at least have a big barrel full of water?
Yeah,
just under. Yeah, Yeah. But so it's more about the ventilation, the fume extraction.
Ventilation and tool storage for the grinder.
Okay.
I need to figure out a better way of doing it, but I haven't come fully there yet to realize how that fits into the workshop.
In your defense, it's not your workshop, you're renting. So I bet installing proper ventilation in a workshop that's not yours and that will require some kind of transformation of the workshop is not easy to do.
Yeah. I mean, I'm allowed to do almost whatever inside the building.
Okay, cool.
I have asked for permission and he's like, yeah, stop asking me. Just do what you need to.
Do your shit. Don't bother me anymore.
Don't tear the building down and I'm happy. Yeah, exactly.
That's good.
So there's a lot of things I could do and there's a lot of things I bought equipment to do. Like I have a fireplace vacuum to hoover up hot ashes and that kind of stuff because a friend of mine recommended that and it works really well to hold the hot sparks and all of it. There's nothing in it to catch fire. That's what it's built for.
Okay.
But I don't have a good way of using it and capturing all the stuff. And one of the things I just need to do is just make a cardboard mock-up and see what shape I want, lay that out, cut it out of steel, weld it together, and make some adapter to get the hose on there and like all of those things. But it feels difficult because I don't actually want the grinders to be where they are at.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have anywhere else to put them. So I'm sort of stuck in that little loop.
Yeah.
But as I said earlier, I think I now have an idea for how I can rearrange the workshop to make it feel better to move in, to work in and move around in. I'm not sure if that will actually free up any space for the grinder, but maybe I will realize something else when I'm there and it will be better.
If you don't try it, you will never know. So it could be a good thing to take just one day off, reorganize, test it for another day, see how it goes, and decide from there.
And when it comes to workshop, as both of you know, it's very much incremental.
Mm.
Every single time you build a new workshop, for lack of a better term, you start out in a far better position than last time you built a workshop.
Yeah.
But even so, it is never perfect. It is just functional in the beginning, and then you sort of add on bits on top of other bits, and it gets convoluted and a bit messy, but hopefully it moves in a direction that is better and better to work in.
Certainly. What about you, James? Do you have one?
So I'm going to throw it back. I'm going to say everything you do can be improved upon.
Oh.
And I'm going to talk about what in wanky business world is called change management. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of hesitancy about like, you know, using terms like that outside of like a workplace setting. People don't want to be change managed. They don't want a project manager.
Mm-hmm.
The way I look at it, because this is my personality, is like, I can just steal this advice that people pay thousands of pounds for by Googling it. So there's actually a couple of really helpful models that you can look at, and nothing is new. Everyone is just describing the same thing that we all kind of recognize, but sometimes it does actually help to have a model to place things on. It doesn't fix anything. So like I've kind of got a bit of a design background and I like Kurt Lewin. He was a guy who worked, he looked at factories kind of in the early 1900s and figured out that, you know, you can make subtle influences on people to make them work more efficiently, and really interesting stuff about people. He came up with this concept called action research that I like, which is a bit like agile. If people know what agile is, it's a method of working. It's basically you do little change and you keep checking you're doing the right thing. Agile is not new. It was 1900s or something. Anyway, he came up with this thing called the force field analysis. So he says that if things are not changing, they're frozen. Mm. And that means that you've got equal forces of change it against don't change it.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't make you do anything, but it does make you think, right, well, all I need to do is change one of those. So if I want to get better at leatherworking, I need to change something because, you know, it's not passively just happening to me.
Mm-hmm.
It might be. Maybe you are doing a course. And you are getting better. But if you want something to happen, you are going to have to change something. That's either, in his idea, get rid of something that's stopping you, or improve upon something that's pushing you. So as much as I might want to sit here and really want it, I'm not wanting to do it more is not happening. So I'm going to think, right, I'm going to have to do something. And that is...
Are you saying that manifesting doesn't work?
No, apparently not. This is the annoying thing about humans. You can't just think it. And so, again, a bit like when you rush a project, occasionally it feels like it works. It reinforces your bad habit.
So I
quite like stealing all of these business wank terms, that rather than paying a management consultant, I can go, oh, I could do that. Okay, well, that one sounds stupid. That one said, so you can go through and look at like Maurer's Three Relationships or Bridges Transition Model or Cotter's Eight Steps, which I am reading off the screen. I don't know these off by heart. I've got Obsidian open to the left-hand side. Anyone who's going, God, I thought this guy was normal.
No one ever thought that.
No, not I thought this guy wasn't a muggle. I think if there is something that's going on, you do have to do something. Weirdly, a lot of podcasts in the make world have been talking about this recently, like Making It had their eating fried food ones. I think even your guys' last episode had a lot of you have to go out and do something. So yeah, I think everything can be improved, and it's up to you to change something. Yeah, you are the only barrier in a way.
Laziness can be improved as well.
If you want to be more lazy, Matt Damon says he loves, his favorite thing is doing nothing, and he is great at it.
Yeah, I'm going to add it too, but it's not like...
Not Matt Damon, Matt LeBlanc.
Matt LeBlanc?
Yeah.
Different Matt.
That makes more sense.
Different Matt. Yes. Yeah.
I think it's just my brain's like, Matt Damon, all the time. There you go. I'm back to being not normal again.
It's very difficult to be able to not do anything.
Yeah.
Because you have to sit and not think about anything, which is pretty hard to do.
Like an entire religion based on that, isn't there? Chop fire, carry water. Enlightenment. Yeah. Chop fire, carry water.
Yeah, I couldn't do that.
No, chop fire. God, I'm getting this. I'm zen right now. Chop wood.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that sword.
Maybe firewood.
You posted the other day. If I'm throwing it back to you guys, what do you feel has you got better at recently? And why do you think you got better? Or why did your temporary thing change?
Knowledge about PCs. When? I improved that a lot recently.
Yeah, why?
Because my computer was fucked up, so I had to dive back into what I thought I knew about PCs when I built my first one and my second one. The second one was actually for my brother, but trying to fix a computer that you've built is somehow... requires somehow more knowledge than the one yet you only need to build it. You have to understand how it works more than only knowing what parts you need and how to put them together. Yeah. It's like trying to fix a car. I mean, you know, you have a flat tire, you change the tire. But if your engine is not starting, you need to understand why it's not starting, and you need to know where to check in order to identify the faulty part in your engine.
I was more like humans. Yeah, you need to go to university for a number of years to learn how to fix them, but it's a couple of lessons at school to know how to make them.
Yeah, exactly. And but practice is important in order to both things. But honestly, it was a bad for a good. In the specific topic that we are discussing, it was having this graphic card fry had pushed me into, okay, your computer has a problem. You need to know more about the computer because you're using this thing on a regular basis. So far, I only saw my computer as a working tool, and I had never any issues with it. Whereas any tools that I've used in the past, sewing machine, router, table saw, whatever, at some point I had to do some maintenance on them. And it was like this with my computer this time. So something is broken, you have to fix it. It's better if you fix it in a cheap way. And in order to do so, you have to identify what's the faulty part, what's completely fucked, what new part you need. So I knew more, but it was also the opportunity to plan ahead. And even though that computer was working great, it was a temporary solution. So now the PC that I'm going to build for myself in the next days is supposed to be a better long-term solution. Because it's not only a tool that I'm going to be using for the video editing or the pattern making or my everything that is relative to my business. I want to build a tool that is going to help me efficiently in my workflow, so to speak. So I know the difference is not great, but to me it's perfectly clear. This next tool is going to be the best tool that I can buy for myself in order to make my work more efficient. Mm. So it's like what you said, like the first router that you buy and the second one that you buy, the first one you never touch it again because the second one is so much better. That's kind of my way of thinking things here. It's like I'm gonna build myself the best tool that I can afford in order to save me money, so save me time, be more efficient, be quicker when I have a task to do on that damn thing. And therefore, I will also save time and save money in the other aspect of my job, whether working or else. So that's a knowledge that I acquired in the past days, like knowing more about this specific tool. And I don't understand myself. I don't know why I didn't do that earlier when I usually do that for any kind of new tool I get. When I bought the table saw, I watched so many hours of videos about how to set it up, how to use it safely, the common mistake that you shouldn't be doing because it's gonna ruin your it's gonna cut your pinky, it's gonna ruin your head by having a kickback, or just ruin the piece of wood that you are using, and therefore you will have to buy another one or use another one, and so on and so on. And I never did that with my computer. So I know I talk a lot about this computer, but it's like very central in my workflow. If I don't have a computer, I can't work, so to speak. Because, yeah, I can cut leather and stitch together, but if I didn't manage to make a pattern on my computer beforehand, it's not going to look as good as I want it to be. So working on my computer is the first step of anything that I do now. So it's a essential tool, and I blame myself for not taking the time to know it better and to use it better before that old mess of frying stuff inside happened.
Did you recognize it as being that important before it broke?
No, of course not. And if I had at the time, I would probably have I could have prevented the breakdown, the break of the frying of this computer, because I could have known or realized that, yes, this extension cable that you paid $5 for are not the great thing to put in a expensive piece of machinery that you are using on a daily basis and rely on for your business. It looks nice, that's great, but would you put a bow tie on a table saw before using it? No, it might look nice, but that nothing, it will not improve the way you're going to use that tool. So get rid of it because it's not necessary and it can only just distract you or cause an accident. That's a stupid analogy, but that's pretty much it.
But equally, you've also got to recognize that making that change, doing prevention, is incredibly boring.
Yeah,
you know, like prevention is the dog that doesn't bark. You don't notice it. You avoidable accidents are not accidents. They're not exciting. They're not. No one ever notices them. No one ever goes, "God, I'm really glad you changed that before it went wrong."
Yeah,
no one thinks. You only ever curse people like, "Oh God, I crashed my car the day after I got it serviced."
Mm.
Yeah, no one. Unless, ever,
unless you are extremely anxious and every time you come back home, you're like, oh, thanks God I didn't have an accident today because I took care of my car, last week. If you are not like this, you don't see what maintenance and prevention and good care of your tools and yourself.
Almost everyone who does preventative something is because it's happened to them badly before.
It's experience.
It's so hard to motivate yourself to do right. I should do this because I have heard it is a thing you should do, and I know I'm doing it for the right reason. So I'm going to applaud anyone out there who has done a preventative thing.
In any way, shape or form, like for the your workshop, for your tools, for your car, for your health or whatever. That's great. That what you are doing is great. Even though it doesn't pay like right away, it will one day.
Yeah. And you might never notice.
Yeah.
Raz, what have you improved recently and what made you do it?
That's a good question. The most recent thing I can recall is building the new tool stand in the workshop, which granted I did a few months back. But that is based upon, I made one that I thought was kind of good. I started using it and realized all the ways it's shit. And then used that to make a better one. And now with this conversation and with all the other things I've been distracting myself or getting distracted with thinking about, it's like, I probably should make another one the way I did, or actually finish the one I did, because I never put a top plate on it to hold like hand tools, like punches and chisels and all of it.
Did you realize it was shit because you used it or because you had feedback from someone using it?
No, because I used it. I realized it. So the old tool stand I had, I didn't think through enough and didn't look up how other people have done it as I designed it. So I forgot about one really simple, important thing. It's just how do the tongs behave when they're hung up?
Yeah.
And how does hammers behave when they're hung up?
Mm-hmm.
And what I did is I ended up putting in multiple rows close together that I could put hammers in.
Mm-hmm.
But because the hammer heads are so much bigger than the handle, they would cover up the next row.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I made lots of rows to put lots of handles in, I couldn't put all that many hammers in because they would cover up each other.
Okay.
So when you designed that, did you think you did a good job?
I thought it was fine. I thought it was a good starting point.
Exactly. And this is the weird problem with doing things. Most of the time, when you know you're doing something badly, you know you are.
Mm.
It's the times when you're like, I've worked really hard. It's like, you know, people say about films, no one sets out to make a bad film.
Mm.
A bad film just happens. You know,
I have names. I have a lot of names. About
but they didn't go, right, what we're going to do is sit down, the producers,
I can show you some did. I'm certain of it. Some did. We're gonna make the worst film in history, and they almost succeeded.
Mm. Well, that's the plot of the producers, and they set out to make the worst production, and they make a brilliant one. But the point I'm trying to make is that when you do something, you never really set out to do it badly. All of these things are your unknown unknowns. You don't realize that actually are. You think you're doing a good job. So now, having thought about that, you were saying earlier on you were going to redesign your forge.
Mm-hmm.
Does that change what you're going to do now?
A little bit, but not all that much. There's things I've considered, like adding a tool holder to the forge, somewhere to hang your tongs.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that will have to be really close to the big thing that gets really hot. And thinking about it, it's like, well, then that's probably not a good idea. Unless I can put it so low that it's out of reach of the radiant heat, kind of. But then it's kind of defeating the purpose because then it's not easily accessible.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll be making, and I've been thinking about this a while, but and I'll end up making just small tripods with some stretch metal plate on top with lots of hole in it for airflow. And then a bent bar around that just to hold tongs and hammers. And that will be fine. That will be good. I need a few of them so I can put around the workshop so that either I can use them so that I have all of the tools I need for an operation around it near the anvil and don't have to go back to the welding table. I can keep the welding table clear.
And what about the boom arm? that you can attach to the forge, and therefore you can put the tools that you need during the operation, and when you don't need them, the boom arm, you can just push it back near the forge. It doesn't matter if you get hot.
What kind of arm?
What any time kind of arm, like a boom arm from for the microphone, or just an articulate thing that you
like
can
like an angle string.
Yeah, whatever. Something that can fold and unfold to hold the tools when you need them in front of the forge.
No, but also the
fold back when you don't need it.
Well, another part of the reason I don't want it close to the forge is because of students. So I need to design it in a foolproof way. Yeah. And there are some really, really ingenious fools out there that find really interesting new ways of hurting themselves and damaging things.
Sure.
If I just eliminate all of that aspect, that makes things easier.
Yeah.
It also means that a forge takes up less footprint in the forge. Mm. It's easier to walk around it, meaning it's more comfortable to a lot of students to walk around their forge.
You have the added difficulty to need to work sometime on your own in the forge and also welcome student.
Yeah.
So it's not one or the other. It's it's a combination of both. So that's difficult.
So the thing you're trying to make, is it both long-term storage, like storage when you're not using it, but also storage when you are using it?
Yeah. Well, are you thinking of I've been talking about two different kinds of tool holding systems.
Mm.
The big one that goes up against the wall where everything is.
Yep.
And then smaller ones that we can bring out that the students can put all of the things they think they're going to use or need and have easy access to it as they change tongs, use hand tools, all of that. Kind of which one are you asking about?
That's what I'm saying. Are you trying to design one thing that does everything, or are you trying to do... So I think you're trying to say, look, the thing we're talking about is the close to the fire, use it temporarily.
Yeah.
Because that is a different solution for when you're doing it and when the student's doing it, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Or it's the same solution, but multiple of.
No, it's two different solutions. It definitely is.
Your personal one is either the same as the student's temporary one, and it's, or I guess you, is it custom to you?
Currently it is custom to me, but it's also a thing I want to redo because different ideas now. But that's how I made my sort of movable vice stand with tool holding on it. I just used the parts I had around. I also did the same mistake with when it comes to tongs. Like, I used 12 mil round bar. And unless you have a 12 mil gap at the top of the tongs where sort of the reins begin, the arms will just splay out wide.
Mm.
And that's really awkward and weird. If I use flat bar, they will splay out a whole lot less. That's what I did on the new system. That's what I will do on this one, on the next one. And a few other things where, like, it is really nice and good for some things. But there's so many other things I now know that I can improve upon that I would like to improve upon. So even my special one, I had to redo at some point, but it's good enough or not bad, not too bad yet.
Good question before we go to the focuses of the week, to the both of you, but also to the listeners, because I'm very interested in the answers. Everything that we've discussed so far is mainly about making the workshop and how we analyze the way we think when we make and when we are in the workshop. Mm. Do you apply the same logic, the same approach to improvement in your personal life, or is just two separate things for you?
What personal life?
Yeah, I know. James.
Yes. And the cheat is, I've not been reading from my maker obsidian thing. Mm-hmm. I've been reading from my professional development one.
Okay.
And that's the thing. It's so easy to think of yourself, like you silo yourself. You're like, when I'm in a maker thing, I don't care about rules. I don't care about this. I wear like Carhartt jackets and this and that, and you define who you are. But actually, there's no reason that you shouldn't use what's effective in your life you know, in your professional life. Say you do work in, you know, an office and you have a manager and you have this and you progress through and you think, why do I work effectively at work? Mm-hmm. If you like your job. So Jan was saying last week, oh, he really likes his job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder if he uses the same things that make him good at his job to be good at making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he works in sales. He does sell, or he makes things to sell. You know, do you use the same tips, you know, the tricks?
Yeah.
And it doesn't come naturally. You know, work, you know, or sorry, job me, to borrow a Rasmus thing, is not the same as maker work me. Because mm-hmm. it's all work, but job me is different. But actually, there's no reason I can't cheat and use the things that someone has paid for me to go on a course to do to make my makery life better. I just have to get over the idea of using business things for fun.
Yeah.
Get out of my own way. Realize what I am good at. Realize what makes me better, even if I dislike the idea of how it has come about through a corporate retreat strategy day. It's not what I've done, but...
Yeah.
That sort of thing. So I try to. So I try, not everything I do tries to do these things, but the things I really want to change, I will accept that human fallibility, I am not good at wanting things into existence. I'm going to have to do something about it.
Do you find that your job, James, helps the maker, James, more than the maker James helps the job James, or does it works both ways?
Amount? And I think as job James gets more, you know, senior, works in the same place, and you're allowed to let those worlds merge a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
The I like being a bit disruptive. I like chopping and changing between things.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me most effective. Okay. This is the idea that, you know, everyone has their own strengths.
Yeah.
You know, this is not the you do your personality test and you're an ENTPJ.
Mm.
This is the you are good at making decisions. You are good at this. And I think a lot of makers are going to be quite similar in terms of their strengths, but there are so many different strengths out there. Nobody is going to be the same.
Yeah.
You have to realize that what you're good at in the bits you choose to do with your life are also going to be the things you're good at in job life.
Yeah.
You just have to figure out how to do them. So sure. I think I probably get more benefit. Job James gets more benefit from Maker James than Maker James does from job.
Okay.
Hmm.
Raz?
I forgot the question.
Okay. The reason I asked the question is because I observed that some people who are absolutely not in the makers community, they are absolutely not makers, have great skills when they are doing their jobs, and they are unable to apply those skills in their personal life. And it has nothing to do with like sentimental life or whatever, but just cleaning the house, doing the grocery in an efficient way. They are very good at what they are doing. They are quick to decide. They are very quick to act and to get organized in as long as it is within their job, their field. But when it comes to getting organized in their personal life, and it's one third of their time, they are unable to do it. They can't translate those skills that they have in their job in their personal life. So, and it's not something that I've observed when it comes to makers. Most of the time, the makers can apply those skills in different fields and different aspects of their lives. So that's why I'm curious. I'm asking to listener if you have a different experience or observation, don't hesitate to reach out, because I'm very interested in your answers.
Isn't it kind of a trope that a fair bit of therapists get into therapy because they need therapy?
No, you need to get therapy in order to become a therapist. That's also a trick. You have at least in France, you have to be in therapy for 12 years before you get your therapist degree.
Okay, because I was that is amazing. I think that sounds like a really good thing. But I was going a bit further with it in the sense that it seems that sort of often you hear the story of a family therapist that mm-hmm. themselves has a terrible personal family life.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're not able to take like the lessons they learn about how to work as human beings together and use that to look at their own life.
Yeah,
because that's painful and that's really difficult to do.
We have a saying in France for that. I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't know if you have the same, but it's like the shoemaker has the worst shoes of them all, sort of. I think that that's also true. You can. We did an episode all about knowing yourself, and sometimes it's very easy to recognize good, like wonderful qualities in other people or enormous flaws in other people, and you can't identify the same flaws or quality in yourself because you're probably not objective about yourself, and can also work the same way with family therapists who are like have a very disorganized personal life, to put that in simple terms and nice terms.
I try to be good though about it's weird to say, I try to be good about not having that separation mentally between personal life and work life, because there's so much good that can come from having a bit of overlap and thinking across quote unquote the two disciplines. Not that living in itself is that much of a discipline. It's a little bit of, it's hard to know that I need to focus on work and then working a lot and then still have the energy to come home and start analyzing the personal things that needs work.
True.
That's a segue. Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
I heard the word focus. I had a weird cough.
Yeah, that can end it there. I have no idea where I was going with that. It's just sort of realizing that I'm trying to, but I have no concept of how good I am at it.
Yeah, you are. I think the first step to so many things is realizing that you won't know. We are crap at knowing things.
Yeah, even but things we know or asking, think we know.
Asking yourself the question is the first step. So if you are wondering, if you're asking yourself how good I am, and you start thinking about it, you will have the first clue, and then you would go from there. But
there's one thing I really like that I read a while back. That's sort of the question of, what do you think you know, and why do you think you know it?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. That's a really tricky one.
Yeah, and so kind of like, don't assume anything.
No.
At the same time, you get overwhelmed if you start questioning everything.
Yeah, you don't have to question everything. You just have to ask yourself the good question. And sometimes that's the most difficult thing to identify. Which one is the...
Yeah, you can focus on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, good, good.
Good, 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 good. you did well.
We avoided a deeper rabbit hole on psychology.
Yes.
So my focus is going to be the iron snail.
Okay.
Oh.
So the iron snail is the YouTube, Instagram, and shop of Michael Christie, I think is his name. He is I think he works in something to do with high-end watches, but the thing he likes as the iron snail, and I'm going to keep repeating it because I'm the person listening to podcasts who forget what the, as I've said before, what the person's talking about or who they are. They sound great. And then it's gone. So the iron snail is a guy who does videos about fashion, sort of. His videos are titled something like why the US Army loves this leather, why these $350 denim jeans were made for Japanese bikers.
Mm-hmm.
He essentially does deep dives over 10, maybe 15 minutes as someone with an who makes his own clothes to sell. He does limited runs of high-end outdoorsy-ish jackets, not the kind of like, I go hiking up Mount Everest three times a day performance, but I like to go outside and I want to not get cold performance jackets or jeans or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he will look at them and say, why are they this much money? What is, you know, why is this cotton from this place? What is a double zipper doing on this jacket? I think his videos are really entertaining. So he goes, at least they all seem fairly consistent in style. He talks about them in a really interesting way. His humor is brilliant. And I would thoroughly recommend anyone who has even a passing interest in why your jeans are riveted together, in the pockets rather than just stitched, or why the belt loops on my expensive selvage denim jeans loop underneath another bit. If that makes you go, oh, that's interesting, you should go and check out The Iron Snail.
Very nice. Very cool.
It sounds like a rabbit hole kind of YouTube channel.
Yeah.
It is. And so anyone who is friends with me and has seen these recommended, you know, I bought the poacher boots from something, it's my fault because I've been watching them all. They're well worth at least watching one of them. And by one, I mean all of the ones that you end up being interested in. Yeah, go and have a look at The Iron Snail.
The Iron Snail.
Yes, I've said it enough that if you're in your car, you will now remember.
The what snail again?
The iron snail. Iron, okay. As in made of iron.
Okay. With an R.
Excellent.
I-R-O-N.
Okay.
Can I go next?
Yeah, please.
Because my recommendation is not iron, but bronze. And it's Thack from Thack Ironworks. And that's how he says it in every single video. And it's kind of hilarious. He is a crazy Canadian who seems like he has tried to embody that 80s blacksmith Conan the Barbarian style of making things and aesthetics. Mm-hmm. And he's really, really good at doing a lot of sheet metal work, mm-hmm. especially when it comes to making armor things and like just sculptural work as well. Like, there's so many of the things he does inside of metalwork that I haven't seen anyone else do to the degree he does them. And he's doing like that D&D style, that Conan the Barbarian thing. He, for shits and giggles, made himself a hobbit house in his backyard, which is like a one room thing that just has basically room enough for a fireplace and a bed.
Nice.
And breakfast.
Oh, yes, and second breakfast, of course. Second breakfast in bed? Is that a different thing? I don't know. But yeah, Thack Ironworks. He sometimes does like things for like motorbike parts. He does things for music videos. He does a lot of really interesting different things. And recently he's done like a 4-part series of making a gladiator helmet, which, funnily enough, is a redo of a project he did like 20 years ago or something, I think he said, when he started out.
Nice.
And it's fascinating to see like how he critiques his old work and how he describes what he wants to change and how he go about it. And then it's also just a myriad ways of problem solving when you want to stick all of this funny shaped bit of bronze together and want it to look good. And yeah, I really like him. And he has a really good way, kind of this self-deprecating way of talking about what he's doing.
Cool.
Thack from Thack Ironworks.
T-H-A-K, Thack.
Yes.
No C.
Yes. Correct. You did the Googling and found him.
Yep.
Obviously.
Yeah. Red, how about you?
I have three.
Oh, fuck off.
Yeah. Initially, I had five, so... so, shut up.
That's still too many. You're not making things better. You're just saying you have too many.
It's called focus, not vague, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or, no, but yeah.
Distraction.
Yeah, no. The first one is actually on TikTok. He's a guy called Daniel, but his channel name is Mr. Murals. Like... Mr. is MRMURALS. He's a painter.
Did he makes get that?
He makes painting on walls, mainly in hospitals, children hospitals, and that's how I found the guy. He's like decorating rooms and corridors in children hospital, which is absolutely fantastic, because an hospital can be super scary, especially for a kid. So having like characters that they know, like Woody from Toy Story or Mario or whatever, can be a little bit comforting for them. So I love the idea. I love his work. My favorite one personally is the one that I put in the show notes. It's like if you go on the TikTok page of the guy, so Mr. Mural, you have usually on TikTok three pinned videos, and it's the third one after that. It's called "They Ask Me to Paint Their Kids in the Living Room," and I just found it absolutely stunning. You have three kids in gray, and one is like putting, just like if the wall was a curtain, is putting on it, and behind that you have all these shiny colors of everything that the kids like, and this mural is absolutely fantastic to me. It's just like a lot of emotion in it, and I loved it. So yeah, Mr. Mural on TikTok is doing great work, especially for children. If you want to encourage him and see nice stuff, go on TikTok and check his channel.
Yeah, it does look like he does kind of like spray paint, but very almost photorealistic, but of cartoons.
Yeah.
Murals on walls.
Yeah, that's the right pronunciation.
Mr. Murals.
Thank you, James.
M-U-R-A-L-S.
Yeah, that.
Maybe Josh should have James to read all of the focuses.
Yes, please.
I'm not going back through every episode and trying to differentiate which is leather and which is laser.
Yeah, you figure that out on your own. I mean, I'll try to do better, but yeah, you have context.
Your English is still better than my French.
Yeah, I don't know.
Just a law.
My second and third one are actually TV shows that I watched this week. So the famous Three Body Problem on Netflix. I really liked it. I know for a fact that it's not gonna please everyone. A lot of people will be disappointed because I read the book and the book was better. Probably, I don't know. I didn't read the book. I just really enjoyed this TV show. It's very well made. It's extremely well produced. The CGI are stunning when they need to be stunning and just subtle enough when they need to. Very well executed, and the actors are wonderful. It's worth the watch, honestly, and I can't wait, and I hope there will be a season two, and I can't wait for the season two. And I will not read the book before I've seen everything on Netflix. So please don't tell me how it ends. But yeah, if you like sci-fi and good TV shows, well-produced one, complex one, can be slow at time, but it's also for the character development and the story development. So don't, it's not just like all in your face all the time. Three Body Problem, very well made. And the last one, shortly, it's called Constellation. And same thing, it's about space, sci-fi, not that much about space, but it's sci-fi, it starts in space and things happen. And there is the wonderful Noemi Rapace. I don't know how it's pronounced. James, Noemi Rapace was the pronunciation of her name properly. If you know, you don't know, that's fine.
Naomi Rapace?
Yeah, probably. Wonderful actress. She's very good, very, very good. So yeah, if you're interested in TV shows, you have time or insomnia, and you want some sci-fi stuff, I can only recommend you Three Body Problem and Constellation.
Oh, she's Swedish.
Yes.
N-O-O-M-I-R-A-P-A-C-E.
Yeah,
Noemi Rapace, if you are French.
Yeah, exactly.
She's Swedish, so who knows?
Well, in French, it would be Noemi Rapace, but close enough.
Yeah. Right.
I'm not going to fill in for the Swedish.
We'll get KJ on, he can tell us.
Yeah.
Yes, please. Anyway, there is a link in the thing that will lead you to IMDb and all the information for the things. So, yeah.
Any last little tidbits?
Yes. Depending on when this comes out, we may have to encourage people to sign up for the Fools with Tools / two-thirds focused treasure trade.
Yes.
There's nothing stopping.
You need to join the Fools with Tools Facebook group to get access to the Google form so you can sign up for it.
Yes.
So it's convoluted. And,
but if you're already in the Facebook group and you want to be part of the thing, hurry up. It's
It is now. You need to sign up by now.
Yeah.
When you have finished listening to this, go and do it.
Yes.
The deadline is 31st of March, I believe.
Yes.
So
yesterday.
If you're listening to this in the future, you can ignore what we're saying.
Yes.
But if you're listening to it as it comes out, we highly encourage you to join into the shenanigans and do the treasure swap and treasure trade and make something for a random fella out there and get something random from someone random.
Yeah, and get to know someone in the Maker community.
Yes.
It is very much not about actually making anything as it was originally conceived. It's about a fun thing to do and an excuse to make something.
Yes.
Yep. So there's that. Oh, and I have a last little thing because I forgot in the beginning. But I had my old scout group stop by the forge last week.
Yeah. Said last week.
I said it would. Yeah, so they said it would, and they did, and it was really, really fun. And there's something about the scouts, but I had forgotten how much I enjoyed hearing sarcastic clapping.
That's true.
It might just be like my scout group or the leader that I had back then and that came along this time again and now, which is an old friend of mine. But he has perfected the art of sarcastically clapping for someone. And it is glorious. And I was just sitting there and just grinning. And I was like, I have missed this.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were into Forge just to see a bit how I do things. But they got a chance to forge a couple of bottle openers out of some of the laser cut blanks, which also sort of dumbed things down for me a bit. Like, no, what's the minimum I need to tell them to make them not die, hopefully not hurt themselves, but have a bottle opener at the end.
Nice.
Oh, nice. And if there were any groups of people who may want to come and do that with you, where would they be able to find that information?
No, I'm not done yet. Shut up.
He's good. No, you're done. You're done. Because I'm editing.
They came to the forge because they want to buy.
Have a good week. Coffee. Thanks for listening.
Shut up.
You can find out the answer to Rasmus's ramble on Patreon at Two-Third Focus.
Fine. It was something wholesome, though. But yes.
Okay, we've done enough being nice. We were nice to you and to Steve.
Yeah.
Come on.
Keep it for next week.
Right. You can find us collectively at Two Thirds Focused on Patreon. And you can find James at Molten Make and all of the multi and makey places. And you can find me at Rasmus Lewin and lewinsmed.no. And Red, you can probably find him at the computer cursing at something because he's old and the computers are new.
And Jan, you will find him next week.
Yes,
like, he has recovered from the vacation jet lags.
From all the people who said actually it's pronounced Aladdin, who then punched him. Go back and listen to the start of the last episode if you want.
Yeah.
Thanks, James. It was great to have you.
It's been great fun.
Have a good week.
Bye bye.